From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. The November jobs report came out this morning. Expectations had been building all week. Economists predicted a turning point, anticipating strong job creation that would start bringing down the unemployment rate. Well, that's not the way it worked out. The U.S. economy added only 39,000 jobs last month, and the unemployment rate ticked up, not down, to 9.8%. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
The government says there are more than 15 million Americans who are unemployed. And on top of that, there are always thousands more people entering the workforce. Young people looking for a job for the first time, or discouraged older workers who start looking again. So bringing down the unemployment rate is kind of like trying to swim upstream against the current. And in November, the economy lost headway.
Right now, we're not swimming fast enough to accelerate.
David Kotak is chief economist at the investment firm Cumberland Advisors.
There's a dynamic going on in this labor force. You need 120 or 130,000 net new private sector jobs each and every month just to keep up with the demographic change in the country. We haven't even reached the level which holds things steady.
That's why the unemployment rate went up. In November, we couldn't even tread water.
The hope had built up for the last few months that we were getting there. And this report said, not yet.
There's a chance that this report will be revised upward and isn't as bad as it looks. And there are other indicators that suggest that the economy is improving, although slowly. To get a sense of what employers out there are thinking, throughout the downturn, we've been checking in with Fred Pierce. He runs a factory in Londonderry, New Hampshire, called Metalworks. It makes all kinds of parts out of sheet metal. And he says he's actually feeling a little more hopeful these days.
Yeah, things have gotten a little bit better. I hate to say that things are much better, but we're encouraged by less sideways movement in our business and maybe a little bit of an uptick.
That's not exactly an enthusiastic, off-to-the-races sort of optimism, and accordingly, many businesses like this one have started to hire, but not that much. Pierce had to lay off nearly half of his workforce during the recession, and he's been hiring people back a few at a time. And it sounds like he's getting close to doing some more hiring again soon.
Yeah, we've been interviewing probably five people a week over the last, since the beginning of November. We haven't hired anybody yet.
So what's stopping you from pulling the trigger and hiring a lot of those people that you're interviewing?
It's a one word, uncertainty. It's still very difficult for us to project what our sales are going to look like in 2011.
That persistent uncertainty across a range of industries is keeping a lot of Americans out of work. Even people with college degrees are having trouble, with 1 in 20 unable to find work. Economist David Kotak.
When you dig into this employment report, 1 out of 8 women who head a household with no spouse, that's the single mom with kids, 1 out of 8 is unemployed, looking for work, highly motivated to find income to feed the family, and cannot find a job.
Couple that with the length of this ongoing and painfully slow recovery, and it's clear that the country is facing more economic hardship for working class people than it's seen in a very long time. Richard Freeman is a labor economist at Harvard.
I mean, the last time we had big unemployment, the early 80s, the Reagan period, that's when we had a big burst of homelessness. We've already seen big use of our food pantries. It's not just a normal recession.
But at the same time, with every month that goes by, there are signs that the underlying economy is improving. Back on the factory floor at Metalworks, CEO Fred Pierce says several different industries he makes metal parts for are placing more orders, and he is getting more confident.
We did buy one new piece of equipment last month. It cost about $150,000.
Economist Richard Freeman thinks that the government needs to be doing all it can right now to come up with tax credits or other incentives to help push business owners like Pierce over the hump to jumpstart their pace of hiring. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
High-level corruption in Afghanistan is just part of what the WikiLeaks cables have brought to light. And tens of thousands of those State Department documents have yet to be released. Now, if you've tried to see them for yourself at WikiLeaks.org, you might have run into some problems. In fact, you probably got an error message. That's in part because all the files and the website itself have been jumping around several different servers all over the world. In some cases, WikiLeaks has been kicked off those servers. In others, there's a shutdown because of what are called denial-of-service attacks, basically computer hackers overwhelming the system. So how does WikiLeaks manage to stay online at all? For more on that, I'm joined by Kevin Poulsen. He's a senior editor at Wired.com. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, what explains the fact that for much of today, you couldn't even find the WikiLeaks page?
Well, the latest problem that WikiLeaks had has to do with a service called the Domain Name System server. Basically, it's a shared server that does the basic lookup of translating a name like WikiLeaks.org that you type in your web browser into the numeric address that the internet actually uses to get you to the website. The DNS provider that was serving WikiLeaks decided that it could no longer perform that function because it was being hammered so hard by these denial-of-service attacks.
How do they overwhelm a server?
A denial-of-service attack, basically, there are hackers that have secret control over thousands or, in some cases, millions of ordinary PCs around the world. Your own computer might be under a hacker's control right now.
I hope not.
One of the things that they can do is they can direct thousands or, in some cases, millions of computers around the world all at once to flood any arbitrary target on the internet with traffic. And so it overloads it. It's like jamming a switchboard. It takes such a small level of will to do this. If you already have a what they call a botnet, if you already have a network of hacked computers at your disposal, launching a denial-of-service attack on WikiLeaks is as simple as typing WikiLeaks' address into your computer.
Now, who do we think is attacking these servers that is carrying the WikiLeaks page?
The first round of them that occurred Sunday, just as WikiLeaks was getting ready to launch the State Department cables, that's been attributed to a self-styled hacktivist who calls himself the Jester. He's, for a while now, been launching these attacks against jihadist websites. This time, apparently, he was offended by what WikiLeaks was doing, so he launched this attack. It was not a very powerful attack, but WikiLeaks was unprepared for it, and so they were down for some hours. Since then, there have been more attacks, and the attribution on those is a little sketchier. They've gotten a little bit more powerful.
Can we assume that there are governments involved with some of this?
I think there's no evidence that governments are involved, and there are so many other likely suspects. There are just so many people with the capability of launching distributed denial-of-service attacks. There's no reason to think that there's a state actor.
The latest was that WikiLeaks.org was basically taken offline and changed to WikiLeaks.ch, which is for Switzerland.
Right. They've set up on at least four regional WikiLeaks addresses. So now they're at wikileaks.de, .fi, .nl, and they're back on .ch. So they're everywhere now, everywhere except wikileaks.org.
Kevin, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's Kevin Poulsen. He's a senior editor at Wired.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here with me as he is most Fridays. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Michelle. Well, last week, millions of Americans celebrated Thanksgiving, taking time to give thanks for family, friends, food, and shelter. But as part of our coverage leading up to the holiday, we reminded our listeners that not everyone is so fortunate. We introduced folks to Noelle Beeman, who shared her personal story of hardship this holiday. And Michelle, she is homeless. Her challenges began when she lost her corporate job last year. And here she is explaining how her world was literally turned upside down.
Trying to make ends meet was impossible. I basically went through my savings, my 401k, unemployment as long as I could get it, and I lost my home. And to see years of personal belongings on the street, I could not stop the tears. And I gathered what I could, put what I could in storage, and the rest stayed on the street. It was devastating.
And so many of you were touched by her story and wrote in to show your compassion, while others told us they could relate. Here's a comment to our blog from listener Ray. He says of Ms. Beeman, "I can relate to your situation, having been laid off 2 years ago and still looking for a full-time opportunity. After being evicted from my home last November, I was grateful to be able to stay with a friend 1 month here, a couple weeks there. But there were times when I didn't have a place to stay and took my chances on the subways. You and your family will continue to be in our prayers. And by faith," he says, "we're claiming a position in a new home for you."
Ray, thank you for that good word. And Noel, we are obviously thinking good thoughts for you, too. So stay in touch. Lee, in this week's parenting segment, we focused on what for some is another form of hardship. We talked to a regular panel of moms about the challenges of working outside the home and striking a healthy work-life balance. And we talked about whether the various entities of government and business are doing enough to ease that challenge. After that conversation, some of the dads in our audience wrote to tell us their stories. Listener William says, like many fathers, he himself has also found that juggling a career in parenthood to be a tough balancing act as well.
My wife and I have three children. When the first two were born, I left my employment to stay home with each of them for the first 9 months of their lives. When I told my boss, coworkers, and friends that I was doing this, many were shocked and could not believe that I would walk away from my career to take care of my children. Although I had done well on my job performance reviews, it was becoming more and more clear each day that it was not acceptable for me to place my children's needs first. Eventually, I ended up leaving the job because I did not want to choose between a job assignment, client meeting, and being on time to get my children.
Thank you, William. And we want all the dads out there to know that we'd like to extend this conversation, so we're working on having another conversation about work-life balance involving dads. So stay tuned for that. Lee, what else?
Well, Michelle, back in August, we reported on the controversy surrounding radio host Dr. Laura Schlesinger. Tensions ignited, you might remember, after she repeatedly used the N-word on air in a rant directed at a black listener who had called into her program for advice about her interracial marriage. Now, Dr. Laura later apologized, followed by an announcement that she would end her show. This all came after a backlash from advertisers and outspoken criticism from civil rights leaders and the like. Well, this week we learned that the host won't be gone for too long. A week after she bids farewell to her estimated 8 million listeners, Dr. Laura will begin hosting a new talk program on Sirius XM Radio. So I guess we haven't heard the last of her.
I'm shocked by that. Right, as if. So thank you, Lee.
Thank you, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also find me on Facebook or log on to our website. Go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.
Director Darren Aronofsky's fifth feature, Black Swan, is set in the world of a New York City ballet company. Natalie Portman stars as an up-and-coming dancer struggling to master her first leading role in Swan Lake. Our film critic David Edelstein has this review.
In Black Swan, Natalie Portman's young ballerina Nina is a candidate to dance the Swan Queen in Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. But her company's artistic director, Tomas, played by Vincent Cassell, maintains she's only suited for half the double role. She's the very embodiment, he says, of the innocent white swan. But for the dark, demonic twin, she's too childlike, repressed. Like a method acting guru, Tomas exhorts her to lose control, surrender to her sexuality, preferably with him.
In 4 years, every time you dance, I see you obsessed, getting each and every move perfectly right, but I never see you lose yourself. Ever. All that discipline for what?
Just want to be perfect.
You what?
Want to be perfect.
Perfection is not just about control. It's also about letting go. Surprise yourself so you can surprise the audience. Transcendence. And very few have it in them.
I think I do have it in.
Ah! You bit me? I can't believe you bit me.
I'm sorry.
Nina bit his lip, and you'd think that would put the kibosh on her chances of playing the Swan Queen. But no, Tomas likes this biting, blood-drawing Nina, and he casts her in the role. But his challenge lingers. Can this sexually immature young woman who lives with an infantilizing mother in a pink bedroom surrounded by stuffed animals become the Black Swan? The writer and director Darren Aronofsky dramatizes vividly, feverishly, expressionistically, Nina's transformation into a more sexualized creature and the visions that accompany that transformation. The camera follows about a foot behind her slender neck as the locations change and doppelgangers pop up left and right. Reflections of Nina in mirrors take on a life of their own. Icky, feathery things sprout from her flesh. There are bloody assaults that might or might not be real. Black Swan is a virtuosic piece of filmmaking, a tour de force, and also, I think, a camp classic, like Showgirls, remade by Roman Polanski. You could have a great time laughing at it and its goofy Freudian method acting cliches if it weren't so bludgeoning. Aronofsky's aesthetic can be easily stated. He wants to give you a drug experience. In his terrific first feature, Pi, the protagonist became obsessed with a mathematical equation, and his mental convolutions were right there in the camera work and cutting. While in his Requiem for a Dream, pills and heroin dictated the fractured syntax. In The Wrestler, Aronofsky crafted an ode to male masochism, to the notion that a man is only truly, ecstatically alive on the brink of self-obliteration. Black Swan is The Wrestler's female masochistic counterpoint, and on its own terms, the film is perfectly worked out. But like most drug experiences, it's largely empty sensation. It leaves little behind but a hangover. Portman gives the kind of performance that wins awards, largely because you're so aware of her sacrifices to play the part. She lost a ton of weight, and for an actress, dances well, although not brilliantly or distinctively enough to convince you that the company director would single her out. When she finally becomes the Black Swan, she does have a great, glittery-eyed, demonic look, and Aronofsky brings her bony face with its black-rimmed eyes into the camera like a close-up of a shrunken head. It is, as Count Floyd on SCTV used to say, "Ooh, scary, kids!" And a lot of critics and festival audiences have been wowed, dazzled, freaked out. When the movie is over, it takes a long time to purge Tchaikovsky from your brain. But if you're a dance lover, I don't think you'll love Black Swan. Although Nina tells Tomas that her goal is perfection, she doesn't really mean artistic perfection. I've never seen a dance movie with so little appreciation for the art of dance. Early on, even before Nina loses it, the camera seems to be shuddering in horror with every spin, and the dancers are all scary-looking, angry, emaciated women with dark hair severely pulled back, twisting and cracking their limbs, puppets of Tomas, that tyrannical male deity. But I left thinking the tyrannical male deity was Aronofsky, and that his vision, in the end, is no more complex or enlivening than a cheap hack-em-up director's, treating your head in the manner of another Tchaikovsky title character, the Nutcracker.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microsopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
He came, he saw, he conquered, and then he left. But before LeBron James exited Cleveland's Quicken Loans Arena last night, he got more razzing and verbal abuse than he has ever had in his basketball career. James and the Miami Heat pasted the Cleveland Cavaliers 118-90. Ouch. It was James' first game back in Cleveland since his televised announcement last July that he was leaving the Cavaliers for Miami. NPR's Tom Goldman reports that James and Cavs fans both got something out of last night's contest.
Okay, Cleveland, 1, 2, 3, go! Feel better? Not yet? Well, that was just the first chorus of booing when LeBron James and the Miami Heat ran onto the court before tip-off. Let's fast forward to about 3 minutes left in the first quarter when James stepped to the line for his first free throws of the night. All night long, you could take your eyes off the court and hear when James touched the ball. Nearly 5 months after James made his infamous decision and betrayed everyone here, that's the sentiment in Cleveland, by not telling his team or his city before telling the world, nearly 5 months built up a great deal of pressurized rage. And this game, circled on so many Cleveland calendars, was the release valve. The chanting started early. Akron hates you let LeBron know that his distinction between his beloved hometown Akron and all the haters in Cleveland didn't exist. There were obscene chants, mean chants, who's your daddy started up late when the Cavs were getting blown out. James grew up without a father. Some of the signs on display, La Traitor, feel the chill, LeBron. And through it all, James looked like he was having a blast. On his way to a game-high 38 points, he skipped around the court. He jawed with the Cavs bench. He even did his trademark pregame powder routine, clapping his hands and spreading his arms wide. And that first time on the free throw line, he smiled and made both. James sat out the entire fourth quarter, sitting nearby, simmering in the front row, was 23-year-old Ryan Napier of Canton, Ohio.
And the thing I said to him when he was over here was smiling with that stupid Heat mouth guard on. I'm like, I told him, LeBron, you never smiled that big in 7 years in Cleveland. He just looked at me and smirked. He's just a piece of trash. That's all he really is. He doesn't care about the city. He doesn't care about Northeast Ohio.
The anger was one way. Here's James after the game.
And I don't have any hurt feelings or heart feelings about this game at all from these fans. I wish them the best.
Some here hoped James would take the opportunity to apologize for the decision. He talked about 7 great years in Cleveland, but he said no regrets about anything. This was as close as he got to admitting that the contrived, made-for-TV decision was a mistake.
You know, like I said, my intentions was on point. Maybe the execution just was a little off.
At one point, James said, I'm moving on. I'm happy in the position that I am. He wasn't the only one talking about closure. 42-year-old Clevelander Don Crump paused on his way out of the building. He was one of many fans leaving with an entire quarter left to play and the Cavs down by 30.
I booed, I cursed, you know, but I came here for that. And now that I saw him out there playing with another team, I can't give him no more energy. I mean, no more energy. He's nothing.
Feeling better, Cleveland? Kinda. Tom Goldman, NPR News.